Good morning. This is Bill Carson talking on behalf of the Rossay Living Museum. It is Wednesday, May 21st, 2003, and it's my pleasure this morning to have with me our friend of many years, Joan Fitzgerald, and Ellen Steves, also, both of whom, of course, are with the Rossay Living Museum. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, Bill.
Joan, this is quite an occasion. This is one of the first interviews we are doing for the Rossay Living Museum. The idea is to record and capture the history of not only Renforth, but all the former villages that make up now the town of Rossay. So great to have you here. You and Ellen are friends of many years as well, and we are all in the committee. So you probably know as much or more about Rossay as any resident around, particularly Renforth. Tell us a wee bit, if you would, about the old Renforth.
Well, Bill, the old Renforth, from when I first knew it, I guess you want my name first, don't you? Or you gave it on. You don't need my name again.
What's your full name, Joan?
Oh, Joan Margaret Fitzgerald.
It is Margaret.
And you were an only child?
Correct. And my family came to Renforth in 1932. And my father had a store, which he brought from St. John, which many people now know got stuck at the underpass down there at Brookville when he brought it out.
He actually brought the store.
He brought the store out from Kane's Corner, where Alec Taylor's store was. It was an Alec Taylor store originally at Kane's Corner there. And then Alec built a new store in the 1920s, and moved this one to the back of it. And that building that Alec built, that big brick building where Alec built at the corner of Bayside and Thorne Avenue, is where the Subway place is now, right at the corner of that great big store. But that was a...
When did Dad bring the store out?
1932.
Gracious sakes alive.
1932. And we put it at the front of what is now Birch Terrace, which was Birch Avenue then, where the Bursick House is now. Well, that store burned about a couple of years later. We had the post office. Dad took the post office over in 1932. And some of the things that my dad did over the period that he was known for in the village was the kids would be, or people would be out fishing, and they'd bring the fish back, and there'd be a fish hook or something, and the cat would be nosing around and would get the fish hook caught in its mouth, and the cat would be brought to my father, and he would use the pliers to cut off the barb and take out the fish hook. Those were the days when my father had a little bit of veterinary experience, and he used to go around with Dr. Donovan, who was a well-known vet in those days. And
so his life was as a storekeeper there in the old Renforth.
In the old Renforth. Another thing he used to do, which he did in those days, was certain breeds of dogs had to have short tails, and he would cut off the puppy dog's tails with the chisel and the hammer. You get the... The tail has little sections like your finger and things like that. And you'd find the right place, and you...
What did Mom do now?
Yes, Mother helped in the store. Mother also baked bread and rolls and birthday cakes and things like that for the first store, when we were in the first store.
Going way back, what was Renforth like in those days? How many people would there have been in Renforth?
Well, as I recall, when we came to Renforth and took over the post office, we had approximately 25 all-year-round homes and approximately 68 summer cottages. Now, you must remember, in those days, Renforth unofficially went from the county line, St. John County line, up to where Dave Hoyt's house is, which is 2242 Rossay Road. And then in 1948, when citizens of Renforth decided they'd like to have streetlights, they were going to take the streetlights from there up to the end. And some people at that portion of it, Mrs. Tapley and Mr. Hoyt, refused to pay their light bill. So the people who were the Light District decided they were going to change the boundary of Renforth, and they took it back to the church. St. James the Less Church there at 2142 was the last official building in Renforth, and that became the boundary when we became incorporated, when we were incorporated as a local improvement district. So that's...
Where did people work then?
Where do people work? Most people worked in St. John. Some people, one person worked down for Mr. Holder at Holder's store, which is now Caldwell's, which is run now by the Steiners.
So that'd be about the only store in Renforth?
Holder's and ours
and
Holder's, yes.
And Holder's.
Yes, and my information is, I have nothing in writing, that the store that we had, this other store we didn't take in 1946. After the store burned in 1934, we had the post office in our house, from
in
the
your fire. Existing home.
No, pardon me. Just opposite where our store is now, almost two houses up. It was a cottage that was owned by Harry Morton. He owned the corner on Fox Farm Road and Rossi Road. There, he owned the corner house, and then he owned the next cottage, and we rented the cottage from him.
And everybody basically. Worked in St. John.
Everybody basically worked in St. John, yes, correct. And then you either went in by train or you went in by bus until you got a car, which wasn't for most people until after the war. And the interesting thing about those houses, when they 25 all-year-round houses, when we took over in 32, at the end of the war, just after the end of the war, it had reversed from your 65 to 25. And now we only have one summer cottage still in Renforth.
Yeah, once the baby boomers started.
All those 25 and 68 houses are now all converted from summer cottages to all year round homes.
Where was the train station?
The train station is opposite what is now Horgan's house at 2054 James Renforth Drive. It was on the south side. Southeast side of the crossing. When you're coming from Rossi Road crossing, it's on your about 100 feet, no, be further than 100 feet, maybe 300 feet down, almost opposite Riverview Avenue was where the station was.
So trains were a major...
Trains were a major thing. We had to take the mail off the train when it came out at 7:19 in the morning and put the bag on. We didn't have a thing that they'd hook the bags off. We had to throw it like a basketball through the doors as the train went by slowly. You'd hoped it was going slowly enough. Now, if you had more than one bag, or heavy bags, like at Christmas time, they would have to stop for you. But if you missed the hole in the train had to stop and back up and pick the bag up and put it on again.
They wouldn't be happy in that case.
They wouldn't be happy. But interestingly enough, on the mail, I could put a letter in our mail bag on that morning before our dad went to the store. We went down to take the bag down. And he'd throw it on the train, and that letter would be addressed to my girlfriend in Nawidgewock, and those mail clerks had to have the mail sorted, and that letter would go off in Nawidgewock that morning on its way up. That was the way the mail. And you could also go into St. John and put a letter on the train, Montreal train going out at 5:15, and that would be sorted in Montreal's mail on that next morning. Those mail clerks worked.
How many trains, you were very interested in trains, how
yes.
many trains would there be in a day?
Okay, the mail train came out at 7:19, which was an hour later in the daylight time, and then it went in, the first one went in early in the morning was the jitney that came down from Hampton, it went in about a little after 7, then the train that we went to school on when I first came out, because I finished my year in St. John Winter Street School, went in at 8:19.
You took the train to St. John every morning?
Mm-hmm.
Every
weekday morning. And came out on the 5:15. You had a train, then you had a train out at noon hour going to Moncton. You had a train in at around approximately 2 o'clock that came from Moncton. Then you had the 5:15 out, you had the 6:15 out, and then you had the 10:30 jitney out.
The jitney?
Mm-hmm. We used to call it the jitney. It was just a self-contained car.
Okay. Oh, all right, like a computer. Commuter train.
Commuter train, right? Yes. Yeah. But the 5:15 out and the 8:19 in the morning, they were called the milk train. They stopped at every place to pick up the milk on the way into town, into the dairies.
Taking it into what then?
General dairies. General dairies was the main. General and Pacific. And we used to get our milk from Pacific Dairies, at the store, the first store. And he had a truck. And it was the milk bottles in those days, those big, heavy milk bottles, those quart bottles. And he would have two carriers. In the wintertime, of course, you couldn't get up the hills because they weren't plowed. They were dirt roads. And those hills, he would have a customer at the top of the hill, maybe one customer on the way up, and he would take his carriers in each hand, six or eight bottles in each one of those they went, and he would go to the top of the hill carrying those and then probably get up there and find that somebody wanted something he hadn't brought. And down he'd have to come and go back up again. Those were wonderful, wonderful, wonderful days in that respect. Another thing, one day, we had a dog named Peter. Now, he was a famous dog as far as Renforth was concerned. He was part bull and part spaniel, but he was more like a spaniel. He loved to swim, and he had curly, curly hair. But as a pup, he and a dog that lived two houses down, and the fellow worked for the Telegraph Times, he was an Airedale, they were playing on the road, and a car came along, and there was an accident, and Peter got his hind leg broken. So Dad and Mrs. Johnson, who was a nurse at the top of the hill, he called her, and she came down, and they set the leg. And they put a splint on the leg, on the hind leg, and they made it longer than the leg, so Peter could walk on take the pressure on the splint. And when they took it off, it was perfect, and you couldn't tell where it had been broken. And Peter lived to be well over 13 years.
So Dad enjoyed and
had
skills.
Oh, yes, he enjoyed.
Where did he learn the skills?
Well, he was always around horses. He grew up as a kid he worked for places where they delivered and in town where they delivered groceries and things. He always drove horses. And his grandfather, they had a farm up in the mill stream. And he was. And then he went over in the cavalry in the Boer War. The war was practically over when he got there, but he had his 21st birthday in South Africa. And an interesting thing about that is, you look after your horses. Now, those horses were down in the hold, they had wood on the floors, but they didn't get any exercise, of course. And Dad used to tell me he had a mare, and when on the very bad storms and things, they would go down and stay with their horses to kind of quiet them. As long as he was there, she was all right. But if he wasn't there, she'd scream when he went away. But anyway, when you got off, disembarked in South Africa, they had a 7-mile trek to their camp, and they had to walk and lead their horses because those horses hadn't had any exercise, and you looked after your horses. You didn't ride your horses.
So he always had a lifelong interest in in animals.
In animals, yeah.
When did you get interested? I've known you all the years I've known you. Part of our common interest was municipal politics. Mm-hmm. When did you get involved in municipal politics? Renforth and then East Riverside, Kingshurst?
I guess it would be about 19... I left working in town and came out in 1955 to take over the present store with Dad to work
55.
With him. 55, yes. And
you were a secretary before that.
Mm-hmm. So I was secretary and bookkeeper, anything you want to say. That was the Renforth the Renforth Local Improvement District, and they decided they were going to have sewer put in, and we had three annual meetings before it was passed that the sewers would go in, and I was asked to go down and take the minutes, and then the secretary was Percy Lay, and he decided he was going to retire, so they asked me if I would do the books and the secretarial work for the Renforth Local Improvement District, and I took that over in 57 and was there until 98.
That's 46 years you've been involved.
Right. It was very, very interesting. Very,
John
very
was the only clerk that Renforth ever had.
I didn't know that.
Well,
they were incorporated in what, 64, 65?
Well, we were incorporated as a local improvement district before that. But as far as the village was, yes. As far as the village was, yes.
And then I had the pleasure of working with you many years.
From 1977, I took on East Riverside.
Until it's?
After Connolly, yeah. No, in 92, I think, you came with Rossi.
Oh, with Rossi.
Yeah.
So you, what's that, 77, 23?
15 years.
How many years?
No, 77 to 87, 15 years with East Riverside. Approximately.
All right. What are your, sticking with politics for a while, what are your most interesting memories of municipalities and councillors and municipal problems.
Well, as I started to say, I lost my train of thought. We had three annual meetings before we got the sewers through, because everybody, when you went to these meetings, and there was a great turnout down in the clubhouse for them, everybody in Renforth had a perfect septic system, to hear them say it. Everybody had a perfect system. There wasn't anything wrong with their system. Why did we need this? Well, we had a few wells that were not testing well. But Renforth is all hills. And you may have a perfect system, but gradually all the water comes to the main road, and you couldn't walk along that sidewalk in the middle of summer if the stench was so bad along the sidewalk. Although everybody had a perfect system, but the ground was just saturated. And so finally, and there was still the same argument you get today when you want to do something. All the people on fixed incomes, they can't pay for it. The sewer was going to be $30 to $50 a year. People on fixed incomes couldn't pay for them. There was the same argument you have as every time we go through it today. And it took three years before they finally got the permission to go. And we were one of the first ones that had one of those fancy, it was the three-way cost between federal and provincial and municipal. And we were one of the first ones to have it in the municipal in around here. And the inspectors would come around, and they were inspecting your books and your work and everything else, right down to a T. In those days, they had lots of people.
Who were the first engineers on that project?
W. H. Crandall from Moncton, Bill Crandall, and he did a fantastic job for us. I mean, he would come down at the, and we used to meet in the main people on that time for that sewer was Mr. Garrett, who was chairman of the local improvement district, Ken Brown, Jane Brown's husband, and Joe Stillwell, Terry's father, and Merv Brown, Roger's father, and Fred Peatman. And Merv Brown and Fred Peatman worked for Domtar, and at that time Domtar came out with the best sewer pipe for laterals, which turned out to be that black stuff, which which lasts and lasts for years and years. But if it gradually, if you put any weight on it, it goes out of round, and it can blister. But that was they worked all the meetings we went to on that sewer. It was fantastic. And Roy Smith from Heartland got the contract, and they laid sewer pipe for $1 a foot.
Wow.
That was in 1959 and 1960 they started.
How much is it today, roughly?
Oh, I have no idea. Ellen could look that up, but could look that up.
How many mayors do you remember? All of them?
Oh, yes, I remember all of them. The first elected mayor was Tom Henderson.
A good, very good friend of mine.
Yes, right.
Late
he
Tom
was the
Henderson.
First, but the first actual mayor who went from the transition from local improvement to the village was Ken Brown.
Okay.
Now I haven't gone through my mind all of those mayors. I'd have to go, but Tom Henderson, Tony McGuire, Bill down in the park.
Well, there have been what, eight or ten over the years.
I think there've been, yes, at least, because first of all it was 2-year term, then it went to a 3-year term, or went from to a 3-year term.
Okay.
Yeah. Pardon me?
Malcolm Berry,
Tom Young, Tony Rickett.
That's right, Tom
Greg Young. Zitt,
Tom
Greg Zitt.
Greg Zitt, yeah.
Yeah, Terry Kilfoyle.
Some of whom are still involved and actively interested in politics.
That's right. And the first grant we got, one of those summer grants, one of those make works for the students, was very interesting. Jack Boyle was one of the counselors at the time.
Jackie Boyle
was counselor. He was down in Cape Park. He was the counselor, and Don McLennan was the mayor. And they came up and met in my house, and we prepared that first application for that first grant, and that was very interesting. Then another very interesting grant. I don't remember what we did on the first grant, but up opposite St. James the Less Church, we didn't have any place to park, And we tried to get the province to widen out there opposite the church, back to the railroad. And transportation said it couldn't be done. So anyway, Grant Lewis was a counselor in those days. And
lived at 22 Broadway.
We lived at 22 Broadway, correct, Ellen?
RCMP, yeah.
Yeah, and then a police chief for Rossi.
Right.
And we got talking about it, and we had this grant to do work. And we determined, Grant determined, that we could put ties in there and heavy rock in there, and we could do it. And we went to transportation, and they said it can't be done, but if you can get permission from the CNR, why, go ahead. Well, they didn't think we'd get permission from the CNR, but the CNR gave us permission. And they went ahead with that grant, and Grant worked hard, and he supervised it. And you know, we have that wide place, that wide place there.
Some
we had all
parking,
these years,
yeah.
Extra parking, and all those years we had it, and it hasn't fallen in. It hasn't fallen in yet. But transportation, we're very surprised when we came back with the okay from the railway to do it, and we got it. That was one of those grants. And then, of course, another grant we had was for the repair of the wharf.
Yes.
That was a big undertaking. What are your best memories of that wharf and the joys of summer there over the years?
Oh, well, I'm told, I haven't seen anything in writing, and I should go back and look, but I'm told that after the day after the big anniversary regatta in 1921, that the wharf that was there collapsed. Now, I've never seen anything in writing, but I've been told that. And after that, they put in the wharf, which was there until, with a few minor repairs, until this new one was put in, whatever year that was, in the
1992 or 3.
Somewhere there, yes, in the 90s.
Which is where you learned to swim, I assume.
Oh, no.
No.
I have no history here. I'm not from here.
But in those days, Bill, we used to alternate swimming. Some years we'd swim off the wharf. Other years we'd swim out on a float from the old clubhouse. The old clubhouse was just above where the haulout is for the boat club now, and below the tracks there. And that was a clubhouse, and we have a picture in the museum here. That was a clubhouse with one big room and a small canteen on it, but with a veranda, lovely veranda where you could sit out up top. And underneath were changing rooms for the men and for the women, and places to store the shells. So it was quite a large building. And then we had a ramp down, and then you had a raft off where we went swimming. And we'd swim between there and the wharf. And one day I came running down, and I ran down the ramp, ran down the ramp, jumped onto the raft. And of course the raft was wet. My feet went right out from under me, and I hit the back of my head.
Ow.
And that was the first time I ever saw stars, and I really saw stars that day. I can remember that. But we used to swim from the wharf there to over to the wharf, and just off on the corner of that wharf was a sandbar, and you could stand on the sandbar and be out, you know, up to here when you went over. But at the wharf we had a diving tower and a diving board, and that dog Peter I had he'd go off the diving board, and he'd go off the tower if they put him up there.
Was rowing big then?
No, rowing wasn't big then. Rowing came back, I would say, in Dr. Bonnycastle's time, and came back for the Canada Summer Games when they built that building. No, we had regattas, but it wasn't. They didn't have a big club like we have now. No, they have a fantastic club down there now. Fantastic.
Going into East Riverside now. How many mayors do you remember there?
Well, John Britton was mayor when I went there, and John Britton was mayor when I left there.
And before him, Bert Cosman.
Bert Cosman.
And when I went on in the early 70s, Jack
Rector was clerk.
Jack Rector was clerk. Bill Gentleman.
Bill Gentleman, probably mayor.
Was mayor.
Art Abel was mayor, but not Art Abel, but Travis was mayor, wasn't he, at one time?
Yeah,
I think so.
We're talking about Eileen Travis's husband, who was killed in a plane accident, working with the provincial government, I believe. Mm-hmm. Was he the first mayor to your recollection?
Well, I've read those minutes and I've forgotten. Have to think about it.
Going back then John Britton, Bert Cosman.
Mm-hmm. Bill Gentleman.
Bill Gentleman.
That was the all before.
And you think Mr. Rector before that?
No, no, Mr. Rector was never mayor. He was clerk, clerk treasurer.
Okay. And Travis, do you think he was a mayor?
I'm not. I know he was a counselor.
Counselor, yeah.
Yeah, I know he was a counselor, but I'm not. I had to go back and read those minutes. Okay, now.
How did the villages compare? Similar? You kept better mementos in Renforth than they did in East Riverside.
Kept what?
Better mementos. You had more pictures and more records.
Oh, that picture, the museum, which is in the picture, now that came about through a provincial grant. That came about through the Centennial Grant. In 1964, and Joe Stilwell and his son Terry, they went about and got all the pictures from all the people.
Okay.
And then they had them reproduced and framed, and we put them up in the clubhouse, and we came up with the idea. I mean, you just couldn't put them up in the clubhouse and leave them with all the things you had going on. So we had boxes of plywood covers made to go on. We had frames around, okay. Big frames, and you'd have about six pictures, then you'd have a plywood frame, and then you'd have the doors that we'd hook up and lock on. And then
that's
where that collection, and then when we put the extension on the clubhouse for the school, for the handicap school, whatever they call it now, community living, when they put that on and we put the council chamber in, and then we moved the pictures in under where everybody could see them all the time. But that was a provincial grant, and Don McGowan and Joe Stilwell and Terry Stilwell.
Don McGowan the lawyer,
Underwriter.
Underwriter, yeah.
And interestingly enough, just as an aside on that, our St. James Lillette Church, the east window was a stained glass window and was in memory of Secord. And I never, in all the years, I never even heard who the Secords were, never thought to ask or anything. So when we were doing our history for our new church that we'd have down here, and we did our history for our 100th anniversary, this last year we started doing some digging around, and I got to be tagged to do all the memorials. So here I find this window, and I couldn't find anything anywhere about the Secords. So finally, I found out that they were United Empire Loyalists, and I went to the museum, and I found the Secords. I'm just looking for something else, and I see in this book, I see this family books, and I look up, and here's the Secords. And so I start looking through the Secords, and I find the person I'm looking for, and I do some more things, and I come down the line, and here I see the name of Flagler. Well, Don McGowan's second name was Flagler. His mother was Marion Flagler. And so that's where the connection came down, that through that Secord family came down to Marion, who's one of the women had married a Flagler, and Don had the name of Flagler in his name. Then I go about two or three lines further, and I see the name of C.J. Markham and Betty Jane Markham. Of course, Canon Markham was the rector of Rossi for years and years and years. And Betty Jane, of course, is now a member of our congregation, not Rossi, but now a member of our congregation. So that's how that came. And the Secords at one time lived in the house in East Riverside, where later what we called the Ketchum sisters lived. Now that's about three or four houses beyond where Dave Hoyt is. It's where Andrew McClellan used to be, but he had the big high tower. If you remember when Andrew, the ham operator, he had the big high tower. That's where he lived. But the Ketchums, and I don't remember them, but apparently I've just forgotten this part. They had overnight guests, and they had little cottages. And Mrs. Hoyt, who lived in the big house next door, and Elizabeth, who lives out in B.C. now, she was home last summer, was telling us about this. Of course, in those days, you didn't have any electric dryers, and you had all your laundry, and you used to have wet days and things, you know. And so Mrs. Hoyt used to take the overflow in her house when there were too many for the cottages. And so one day she said to Miss Ketchum, how on earth do you get your sheets and things dry? when, or, you know, when they're a little bit damp and all that. And you know what she said? We repress.
We what?
Repress with the hot iron.
Oh.
They didn't wash, they just repressed the sheets. And repressed the bedding. So that all came out of the history on that one.
You've had a great interest in the Anglican Church. Tell us about the last many years of the Anglican Church in Renforth.
Well, the Anglican Church was started out as a chapel of ease from Rossay under Canon Daniel, who was a rector there for many, many years, and he used to come down. They used to drive horse and buggy down in those days. And they had afternoon services, and it was just a summer church, Chapel of Ease, but it was built in, started in 1902, I understand, or it was, dedicated in 1902. And
we had... Same spot as the old church?
Pardon me?
Same spot as the old church?
Same spot as the old church, yes, same okay. spot as the old church. And my understanding is that, the official history says it was part of... it was given by from the Hazen estate. Now, the Hazen, Katie Mackay, Mrs. Hugh Mackay was a Hazen, so that's a connection through there. But I had always heard from May Tapley Fawcett that that was part of her grandfather's Hornbrooks estate that went to the church. But May's gone now, so we can't verify that. I mentioned it to Charles one day before he left for BC, and... He had never heard that. So, but that's where that came. And then we made a. We then later before that before the Sunday school was built, I'm told, and this was the early 20s. They used to hold the Sunday school classes and things and parties up in Mrs. Hoyt's house, Mrs. E. A. Hoyt's house, because her husband was a hard worker in that church, a warden and everything, and all things like that. So, and then of course, that was the only church in Renforth. And when they had no water, they had no facilities in that church, and there's a big high mountain behind that church with a great waterfall in the spring and heavy rains, and the water would come in the back in the windows and out on the floor. But they had no water. I mean, now the women worked hard when they wanted to improve that church, and they would hold teas and things. And they had to carry water, or their kids had to carry water, or their husbands had to carry water from both sides.
They had a back house?
You didn't. Well, I mean, we would go down to the river and swim, and we never had to go home. I mean, we had good bladders in those days, as far as I know. We didn't have all the outhouses.
You sang quickly, did you?
Yeah, we sang, yeah. You never had...
Were you active in the church?
Yes.
What were your interests? Choir?
The only reason I got in the choir, I got roped into the choir to go up and sit with my mother, because many times she had to sit up there by herself and she wanted company, and she dragged me up to sit with her. But
was she choir?
Yes, she was choir, yeah. My mother, unfortunately, as far as I was concerned, had perfect pitch. And when anything went off, she had an awful time. So... we all went to Sunday school. We took part in that, and we took part in AYPA, and then I helped out with the AYPA when I...
Young People's...
Anglican Young People's Association.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have dances or parties there?
Parties. You didn't have dances in those days, and you didn't have card parties in those days either.
That was frowned on by the Anglican Church then?
Well, I don't know what's so frowned on by the Anglican Church. I guess it just wasn't the thing you did in the church buildings type of thing.
Yeah.
They built the Sunday school after the church was built, and then later on they joined the Sunday school with the church. But in the olden days you had wooden chairs and you had a big long wooden stove which you had to heat up before the minister came, with a long, long stovepipe that went the full length of the building, so you'd have some heat out of that. If you had any services, in the cold weather. Now the first full-time rector we had was George Reedman. Now he was rector of All Saints in East St. John on Park Avenue there. He was rector there, and he had a church out at Miss Peck, and then He would come to us on a Sunday afternoon, and he was the first director full-time. Then Harold Holder was the second rector. He came to us as a deacon, and he was ordained there. And then after he left here, he went and was the administrator of the Protestant Orphans Home.
Is that right?
Yeah. And then he went down to the States and went back into the ministry. But Harold Holder and his wife was one of the Monies. That wouldn't be the Monie that had the drugstore. It would be another North End Monie family. She was one of the Monies.
Mahoney. Those days were Monie.
But he was our rector then in the 40s, in the 30s, in the early 40s. And then Canon Hibbard was our rector during the war. He was retired from RCS, and he was the rector during the war. And then after that, Harold Hoyt came, and he was there from 46 to 64. And then we had a...
Your memory's not slipping.
No, I've just gone through the history, Bill. And then after Mr. Hoyt left, we had Mac Jones. And then when he left, we had fill-in. We had Archdeacon Bate.
And Jones, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
Remember his son. Well, am I correct?
Don't think so, Bill. He only had small children when he was in Renforth.
The son of one of the former ministers played baseball with my son.
Well, it might have been.
Anyhow.
Yeah, might have been in there.
What other churches were there area?
There weren't any. There was just St. Paul's at Rossay. St. David's when it first, was
United
small,
Church,
United
yeah.
Church, and then ours at Renforth. Now, our people, the people of the community, supported our church and all the things we had, all the teas and all the fundraisers and all the Red Cross and all things. It was a community. It didn't matter what church you went to, you came and supported that. You mightn't come to the church services,
yeah.
But the ladies came and the men came and supported it.
Something about Renforth that they've always turned out for anything.
Yes, it's community. A community.
Issue, the council, Renforth always had the highest voter turnout as far as any elections that were coming up.
It was a very strongest community, even more so than old Rossay, wasn't it?
It was a very strong community in people, yes, because you didn't have, everybody was friends of everybody, and you came to the post office and you came to Holder's store and you met people and we made sure that new people were introduced when they came in and many a time the minister would be there for a half an hour or more and talking to people as they came in the morning and then the ladies would have teas we used to have some down that come when they were trying to build the new clubhouse, and the ladies of the community, Cape Park and Old Renforth, they worked together, and they would have one either month. But the men would come out from lunch. They'd know what time it was, and some of the men would come out by car, and we had a business table, so you'd get them in and out in a hurry, and it was all things like that. Now the McGuires worked very hard in the village. Neil McGuire, that's Bill's father.
Bill and Tony's father.
And Tony's father. He had a horse. Now, he had a wooden plow. That was the only plow they ever had before the roads had anything to do, were more than paths. And he would go around and plow the driveways and things. It was a wooden plow, one of those V-plows.
V-shaped plow. By a horse.
Called by a horse, Molly. And he'd go around and plow the hills, and he'd plow your garden in the summer. But the McGuires and Ned Sowery, who lived up here in Quispam, and he was a motor vehicle man in those days, and he used to have to check the trucks for weight on the roads. And they built the ball fields. I don't know if you remember, there used to be a big ball field down there at Drury Cove that space, where the Drury Cove Road goes in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, between that and the where you go up the ramp, all that field was a big ball field. You had the ball field there, you had the ball field in Renforth, you had the ball field in Fairvale, and we had the CNR Ball League. It was regular, what they call the CNR League. And those ball fields, and our first ball field was down in the field there by Caldwell's, which is all built up now, which was the field in those days. But that was the first ball field, and then they built the other one down there. Now, we needed fill for those ball fields. And if Mr. Sowery wrote on the road and there was a truck with a overweight, well, the fine many a time was to haul a load of fill or two down the ball field, and Neil McGuire's with his plow and his would they would level it. And that's how those ball fields really, really.
What did young people do way back then for entertainment? What was their,
the church was a lot of social activities. Church would be social activities. Well, they always had a ball field. They always had a, and they always played hockey on the river. The boys would go down and clear the ice. I mean, the kid you'd go down. The kids would
just
go home.
Well,
everybody had to shovel their own driveway in those days, you know, or the boys would go around and shovel the driveways. But they'd go down with those hands things and their shovels, and they'd plow off a rink and they'd play hockey, and then you had ice boats. John Robinson had an ice boat on there for years, and
did you skate?
We skate on the river, yeah, skate on the river, yes. And then we go occasionally up to the rink at Rossay, but not very often.
Was ice boating a big deal?
Quite a bit. Mr. Garrett had an ice boat. John Robinson had an ice boat. Jeff Sayre had an ice boat.
Did he?
Oh, yes, Jeff Sayre had an ice boat, yes. But one day we were all skating on the river, and John was out with this ice boat, and he came along. And so he stopped, and so we all piled on the ice boat. Now, you had to lie down on the ice boat in order to get everybody on, and you know. And he starts out across the river, and it's fine before we get out past the point where you get the wind coming up from Grand Bay. But then that was a different thing. So we're going straight for the island. And we can see all the rocks, and we can see the broken ice, you know, on the shore coming up and coming up, and here we are going straight. And John isn't beginning to turn or anything. And the reason he isn't beginning to turn, he's afraid the mast is going to come down, you see, because of the heavy wind when he has to turn. So anyway, we got as far as we dared to go, and he decided he had to turn. Well, sure enough, the mast came down. And I had a stocking cap on with one of those long tails on it. Now, that mast took the hat off my head, didn't hit my head. The mast pulled the hat off my head. But we had to skate back to Renforth and pull the ice boat.
These were all homemade ice boats.
Yes, yes, yeah. Metal skates on them, yeah. They were all, they were all homemade.
There was a Mr. Berg.
Earl Berg, yes, lived at the foot of Gibbon Road, the Gibbon Road Extension. He was a great skier.
Yes, and a handsome family. But he had an ice boat, I think.
May have had, yes, he may have had. That would be probably
his
after the war.
His sons were my age.
Okay, yeah, that would be probably after the war, not when I was a kid around there, Bill. Yeah, no, but what the kids did, well, they played ball in the summer. We swam all day long. You go down and nobody had lessons in those days. The mothers went down with their small children. But other than that, the rest of us all were down on our own. You swam all day long. You'd go down in the morning and you'd come home for lunch, maybe, or you'd take your lunch with you, and then you'd go down and swim in the afternoon. You'd either swim off the wharf or swim over where we were at the clubhouse, whatever it was. And then, of course, we had dances at the clubhouse. That was a big, big room with a gorgeous big fireplace, stone fireplace at one end on the wall. And we used to play badminton in the wintertime.
In the clubhouse?
In the clubhouse.
But did that clubhouse go up? Do you remember that?
Oh, it's up before my time.
That was there all the years?
Until 1954 when we built the new one.
Okay.
and Wally and Harry Scully were very instrumental and of course Harry arranged the financing for it in those days. But the room wasn't big enough for a badminton court, so the lines around the wall were halfway up the wall for the badminton court, like you've got that around here. But it was great fun, you know.
Tennis?
Oh, yes, tennis course. Yeah, we were very, very active in tennis. And there's a picture in the living museum of the tennis court. Now, those were clay tennis courts, and those again were built by the people. You know, the people themselves. And there was a tennis clubhouse at the end of the court, too, where they used to have, the ladies used to have teas. But with a picture of the ladies there, they're in their long dresses and their petticoats and things. Heaven knows how you ever got those all ironed and starched and down.
How you play tennis.
How you pay tennis.
They didn't expect the provincial government to fund all these things.
They didn't the community club through their, I think they had dues of 25 cents or something like that. And you can go back in that book that's down there in the history, Ellen, and you can see, you know, a big night would be if they had a dance and a canteen and everything else. If they took in $10, that was a big night, you know, of all things like that. Because, and then the orchestra, they'd have a band. And Bruce Holder would come out occasionally, and that's Bruce Holder Senior.
Bruce Holder. And Ellen worked together for a few years.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Fill me in on those details.
What night? What year did you come?
I started in 95.
95, right? Yes.
January
95, right? Yeah.
You were together what? 2 or 3 years?
Three years. Right? Yeah. Yeah. And Alan took over the finances.
Okay.
Joan taught me a lot. I knew absolutely. You know, I knew a difference between a debit and a credit when I walked in there. That was about it. I knew nothing about municipal finance.
And she took the course. No, those were very enjoyable years. So. But before Ellen came, though, one little aside, we had two girls in there. One was for the summer, and I think the other one was Lorraine, but I'm not positive. But anyway, a well-known person in Renforth who was very loud and very demanding and quite often was under the influence. He came, I was out, and he came in this day, and he was annoyed about something. And he raved and shouted, and the girls were real upset, you see, nervous. So they came back, and they couldn't remember his name. But I had an idea who it was, anyway.
Gee, let me think.
And sure enough, he came back, and he came in the office, and I must have been inside with them, because I met him at their office door, and I just stood in the doorway. And he started to rave, and he kept coming closer and closer, and I didn't move, you see. And I just stood there solid, let him rave, and his voice it was very loud, and then it would get a little softer and a little softer and a little softer. And the girls were sitting behind there, they were in stitches. And he finally quieted down, and we got him settled out and all of that, but that was one of those days, they were just scared to death. They couldn't believe that I just stand there solid and let him.
Lots of characters over the years, right?
But those were some of those things. Oh yes, and we had one person when we put the meet. Were you there when we? You were there when we put the meters in.
Yes.
We used to test the meters,
mm-hmm.
And we had a fee if you thought your meter wasn't working properly. We would go down and test it, but you had to make a deposit, and then if it was your fault. You know, you'd lose your deposit and you had to pay for it. And so we had this person, and the meter, you could test, you turn everything off and the meter was still going, you knew there was a leak somewhere. So anyway, this person had this, and we sent the crew down, and he wouldn't pay his fee. And anyway, this went on, and he was shouting and hollering and everything. And we said, well, we know there's a leak because we turned everything off and there's a leak there. No, I haven't got a leak. I've checked everything. And in the meantime, he had rented the house, you see. And so the person was in and they got the bill and they said, there's something wrong there. We haven't used all that water. So we said, well, we know there's a leak and it's not outside, it's inside in yours. And we finally, when the crew were allowed to go in, they could hear this leak. You know, when you know what you're listening for, you know, we could hear. And Walter knew it was a toilet. Here was a toilet in a little room downstairs where they hadn't been in for years. And that darn thing was not seated, you see. And that's where the leak was. But it...
Many gallons of per hour being wasted.
Being wasted. Oh, we had a lot of those. You know, you'd go into a house down there and you could hear. And you'd say, gee, you've got a leaking tap or a leaking toilet. They'd never heard it until we put the meters in, and then people began to understand. Because those of us who are on wells, as you are, you know, you listen for those things, and you if you hear your pump running and nothing's running, you wonder what's going on.
Sure. Even
if your pump's coming on.
We had a lot of fun too with the water line coming from St. John's.
Oh yes, yes. Oh, that was.
You were there at the time.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, the.
We had a couple of meetings, and there was like engineers and more engineers.
Oh yes, and we met. We met with the engineers in St. John. Now, they had no idea. They may have known in St. John, but they didn't think it was going to be as bad. That when we came in with their soft water, their lake water, and we had been using well water, which is mineral, and over the years, the sediment in the pipes, which was mineral, and when you took it with that soft water and chlorine, you had a horrible...
Oh, man, there was more things.
Horrible what?
Well, it sloughed off the sediment that was on the pipes, and it would be black coming through, you know, dark brown and dark black, and some people had put filters on, and they wouldn't last a week; they'd be black as black. But that's what was the combination, and it was the soft water and with the chlorine and the hard water, which is mineral. And oh, we had fun with people coming in, because you don't, if you have a white bathtub, you probably don't realize when you put your water in from the well, but if you filled that up with water and didn't put anything in the way of soap or anything else, it would have a blue tinge because it's mineral. But you're so used to it, you don't see it. And that was the same thing with the people in the park. They had never seen that blue tinge. But when we brought the water in from St. John, which comes from a lake and is soft water and has vegetable matter in it from the bottom of the lake and all the things that are in vegetable, it has a brownish tinge.
Everyone was horrified. The word of the day was turbidity.
Yeah, turbidity. Turbidity. That's right, turbidity. A brownish tinge. And we couldn't get it across. But that's what it was. There wasn't anything wrong with the water. People had lived in St. John for years, had never seen that, but it was the same water that they were all using in the city of St. John. Now, Tom Young will say, I went after him one day for saying it in public, that he wouldn't drink the water because, you know, it was brown or dirty. But he was drinking the exact same water in the city and not thinking anything about it. You know, it was. But so I'd send Walter down to bring me up a bucket, in a white bucket. We had those white buckets from the where it came in from St. John, and I'd take a bucket from the clubhouse, which was well water, and Walter would bring his in, and you could see the brownish cast and you could see the bluish cast in the other one. And but if you took a glass, it was clear water.
All the changes over the years, what do you think the residents of Old Renforth think of all the changes and amalgamation?
Well, I still have people who miss the continuity or miss, let us say, well, I guess they miss the office, they miss some place that they feel they know people on a more intimate basis. Maybe that'll change over a year, but you can notice a difference. Certain people come and they like the small things. Other people come and, well, years ago they came, we had people coming from away, and they wanted mail delivery. Well, there was a great kerfuffle over whether you had mail delivery or whether you went to the post office, and a lot of people liked to be able to go out and meet their friends, and it was something to do. They lost that. They
the
lost
social
that,
aspect
the
of
social
the smaller...
social aspect, small community, that's right. When ours went always around, we had the post office, we had the church, and we had the community center. So you had three things that were small and
what was the
needed.
Population of Renforth when it amalgamated with Rossay, roughly?
Oh.
2000?
The population?
About 1580 or something.
Something like that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, you've just recently closed your store, haven't you?
Correct.
When did you close it?
March the 15th.
2003?
2003, yes, Bill.
They're going to miss that.
Yes, and I'm missing it, too.
You're going to miss the
hundreds of people that you're not going to see. One of the nicest things, though, is you don't have to get up to an alarm clock, and you can turn over if you want to for an hour and things like that. No, but I know the Connie's missing it, and I'm missing it as far as that goes.
Same as you would miss the council meeting.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh,
which
yes.
We all miss. Yes,
that's right.
I don't know if I miss.
Oh, yes. Bill, you said you had a good time. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, when we went to school, we went to school by bus, which was not school buses by the school board. That was the St. John Motor Line that had our bus that took the rest of the kids who came into Rustic and Salted all came by van. But from Renforth through East Riverside up to, if you lived less than a mile or less from the school, you had to walk. You couldn't get on the bus. So that went up to where the, I know I remember it as a cow, you remember the Rayworth House by any chance? Mary Ann Holland lives. Yeah. Well, right there, and that was the place where you didn't pick anybody else up after that. But when I came out in 1932, the bus was there, and I'm told that probably in the late 1920s, some of the kids, their parents would pay a nickel, and they would go on the bus rather than ride the horse, the van, which would be cold in winter and long time. So we had that, but that was the SMT, or not the SMT, it was the St. John Motor Line.
Yep.
And they would come, and they came out about 8:15, and they picked us all up and took us to school at Rossay, and then they brought us home at 3:30 on the regular trip of the bus. You had the other passengers on with you, and if you had to stay after school, when we had to stay, very seldom did we have to stay after school for school purposes, but we always had to stay for guides on Friday afternoon. Those of us were guides, and we'd have our...
You didn't have detention too often?
Not too often, no. Yeah, I mean, they had the strap in those days.
What did you call it, Rossay Consolidated?
Rossay Consolidated, yes.
Where was it located?
The corner where the school is now.
Rossay High School is?
No, not Rossay High. That's Rossay...
Rossay Park is now.
Rossay Park is now, right at the corner.
Oh, all right.
Down at the corner, down there. And you can see, if you notice, there have been two extensions put on that school. You can see the center part, and then in 1936-37, they put on the first extension. On the right, you can see that, and then you see on the left when you're looking at it where the other one was. That school was built in 1915-1916, the first consolidated school. In fact, I think one of the first graduating classes was Harry Green.
Okay. What was old Rossay like then?
Very the main part, very like it is today, except you had the two stores at the corner. You had Merritt's store, and I don't know which store, I think it was Robertson's before that, but in my time it was Merritt's store at the corner where that building is now, where you have
Rossay Place or something, isn't it?
Rossay Place, yes. And then across where Benjamin's Books was, yep. Mr. Diggle's store.
Diggle.
Yeah.
Well, were they general stores, grocery stores?
Mm-hmm. Groceries, meat, everything you want. School supplies, everything. And, of course, if we needed to go to the store from when school, we had to have permission to leave the school. You didn't leave the school grounds without permission in those days. You were the responsibility of the school board. From the time you got on that bus until you got off the bus again, you were the responsibility of the school board. And you didn't go off, and only the people who went home for lunch were allowed to leave the grounds. We were never allowed to leave the grounds.
So at schools, you had a school, you had two stores. Any other commercial buildings?
Not that I recall in Rossay. Not in Rossay, old Rossay, no.
Did they have they didn't have a municipal building then?
Would they have had
a council then?
The old fire hall.
Yeah, but I don't know what year that started with Rossay Council. I don't know. I presume they must have met in the old fire building. That's the first building I knew, and where they met there. Yes.
So everyone went into town by
train or by bus.
Train or bus.
We had a marvelous bus
system then.
We had a bus at 6:19, 7:09 in the morning, 6:19, 7:19, 8:19, 9:05, 10:30, 11:30, 12-something, 1:05. I could, many a time I came home for lunch when I worked in the city, I'd catch the bus.
You came home for lunch?
We had an hour and a half in those days for lunch. And I would catch the bus on King Street when the bus office was in the middle of King Street at 1:05. I'd be in the house by 1:30 and have my dinner. We had dinner at noon.
Yeah.
And then I would catch the bus going back at 2:05, and I'd be back for 2:30. It was only a 20-minute run on the bus. And many a time when I worked for the Board of Trade, and I used to go take the train, and I would come home on the bus for noon hour, and I'd get the 2 o'clock train. They'd stop for me at the train, and I'm going in. If I was down at the station, they'd stop for me, and I'd go in on the train.
You worked for the Board of Trade for a few years?
5 years.
5 years.
Mm-hmm.
As secretary or accounting?
Secretary and accounting, the whole thing, yes.
The whole bit?
The whole bit, yep. And one day, we had the general manager down, or the maritime manager down from the CNR. We were into a meeting at the Board of Trade, and after the meeting, we got talking, and I said, I'm going out in the 5:15. And man speaks up. He said, oh, I've got my private car on the 5:15. I'm going out too, 5:15. Why don't you come with us and you can have dinner on the train? And I said, it's only a 20-minute run. I can't get a full-course dinner on the train. But he said, oh, yes, you can. You come. And he said, he had his private train. You see, he was the maritime manager, mm-hmm. and they always had their private cars, those fellows, when they catch them onto the trains. And the private car, and there was a full staff, dining staff, and cooks and everything on that car. And, of course, he had a couple of assistants with him there, and he must have called down. I don't know how they did it in those days. But anyway, I got on the train, and we left. Well, I probably got on about a little after 5, but anyway, we left at 5:15. On a slow order, and I ate a full course dinner before I got off in Renforth.
That's the way to go.
That was, yeah. That
I made a note here. Harry Miller used to tell stories about.
Oh yes, Harry Miller. Yes. Well, that.
Who was Harry Miller now?
Harry Miller.
I'm saying that just for the record.
Right, for the record. Harry Miller went to school when I did, as all the Miller kids did. Then when he came back, he became the police chief of Rosse, and he was police chief for many years, and as the history will show you, when he wanted to, you didn't speed going through Rosse. The speed limit was 30 miles an hour, and you didn't speed going through Rosse. Nobody, everybody was aware of it. People would go if they could find another way home at time, if they were in problems, so they'd find another way home. But Harry, first off, he used to use a speed watch. A stopwatch, rather. And he'd stand at a post, and he'd know how far, when the car would go by, he'd hit the watch, and he'd know when he stopped how far, how many feet it was, and he'd know what your speed was. And that's the way that Harry enforced his... that's before he had a car. They hadn't given him a car. But Harry had an uncanny way of knowing things. And one day he came in. This isn't one uncanny way, but he was down at the clubhouse, at the new clubhouse, and the ladies were having a tea or something, and he was down trying to help them park their cars so they could get everything in, because we weren't using the ball field in those days for a parking area, and that was the old ball field next to it, that we weren't using that. So he was trying to get the cars parked, and he came back to the store, and he stormed in, and he said, women drivers, they don't park their cars, they abandon them. But Harry, one day, Dad and I were at the store, and three kids came in. We didn't know them. They were young kids, not they weren't teenagers. And it was a cold fall day, and they only had sneakers on, no socks, and light jackets, and they were cold. And they came in the store, and we had a cooler over there right where Alan is. And they sat down on the floor in front of that cooler, three of them. And we didn't know them, and so we talked to them for a minute. And they had a great story that they had bicycled down from Moncton overnight, then last night, and they stayed in a barn overnight, and somebody had stolen their bicycles, and they were on their way in to visit some of their relative or something, their grandfather or something. So anyway, I said to Dad, I don't think I'd like that story too much, and I didn't want to use the phone there where they were, so that where they could hear what I said. So I thought, I'm going home and call Harry. So I went home and called Harry, and I explained the situation. And we talked, and he said, well, how about if I just come down and have a look around? And I said, okay, you come in, don't pay any attention to them, just talk. And so that's what I went back to the store and didn't say anything to Dad, and we went about our business. And those kids were there getting warm, and they stayed right where they were. And now and again, we'd speak to them and ask them something. And then all of a sudden, Harry came in. He didn't even look at them. He came over and he started to talk to Dad and to me. And now all of a sudden, he turned around and he said, oh, hi, boys. How are you? And they said, fine. And, you know, he chatted on. And he said, I don't know you. I don't know, boys. And I always like to know who's around here. But how would you like to see the police car? Oh, yeah, they'd love to see the police car. Well, come on out. I'll show you the police car. So all they went out, and he got them in the police car. And he got on the phone, and he found out that those three boys were inmates at the Roberts School down there on Sand Cove Road. They had left there. Nobody knew it. They had walked through the Reversing Falls train bridge, not our bridge, walked through there, followed the tracks out, and came off the crossing at Renforth at our store and came in there. And not one soul, all along the CNR or whether they came by the roundhouse or anything else, had ever stopped them. And they hadn't even reported them missing from the Roberts School when Harry called in. That he had an uncanny way of doing things.
He's very highly respected, as I recollect.
One day, he went up, and there was a car parked with a fellow in it at McLean's Drugstore, which is in East Riverside there. And Harry, that's a young fella. He shouldn't be at a school. I wonder what's going on. So he walked up to him, and the fellow rode down the window, and Harry said, what is this, a stolen car? And the fellow's face dropped. It was a stolen car. It hadn't been reported. It was a stolen car. But he had none. And one night, there was a carload of them out, and they pulled into Caldwell's. And Harry came along, and those fellows don't look to be up to any good. So he pulled in, and they were all in the car, and he walked over, and he opened the car door, and out rolls a bottle of wine. He made them all get out. He took the keys. It was the mother's car. He took the keys and he made them all walk back to St. John. And he called them. But he was uncanny on things like that. And of course, he was out night and day. You never knew.
And originally, he didn't even have a car.
Didn't even have a car. No, no. He was fantastic and the uncanny things. And of course, his wife, she had the telephone in her house. Yanni had the telephone in her house. Yeah, same as Bev Sayre for all those years of the telephone in her and their house, and did all that work for them. It was fantastic.
Tell me about Kingshurst.
Well, I can't tell you too much about Kingshurst, except that
it was part of East Riverside.
That's right. Kingshurst, there was a community, I'm told. No, I got that from Bessie Scoville, who's dead now for many years. But there was an area definitely known as Kingshurst. And so far as I know, it went from the Kingshurst Road up there a few, I don't know how whether it went up as far as Allison Drive or went from Green Road up somewhere. I don't really know the whole
street. Just a few streets then?
Just a few streets, yes. It wasn't very large, as far as I know. But it was never, in my knowledge, it was always East Riverside. But I guess when they incorporated or did something, they had to get this place in and had a name. There was a Kingshurst Station. There was a Kingshurst Station at the foot of Kingshurst Road.
Was there?
Oh, yes. There was a station at Colebrook, station at Brookville, down in front of that Adams house, that Adams Stone house there. There was a Brookville station. There was a station at Tarryburn, right where, just this side of the crossing going into Cape Park, was a Tarryburn station. The stations were a mile apart, actually. Then there's our station at Renforth. Then there's your station at the foot of Dunedin Road, East Riverside. Then the station at Kingshurst Road. They put a Kingshurst Road. They weren't, now the one at Tarryburn had a house in it. These other stations didn't have any homes in it. East Riverside had a home in it. And then you came up to Kingshurst. It didn't have a home. It was just a station like ours. And then you came to Rossay, and then you came to Fairvale, and then you came to Model Farm.
And these were all used for River. Milk pickup and...
And of course there were places in between sometimes in those stations where farmers had their milk out. Oh yes, they were all... I wouldn't say that... anything this side of Model Farm had any milk pickup. You watching your time, Bill? It's 11:12.
Joan, this is a great chance to review and some of the history of particularly Renforth. Looking back and perhaps sort of concluding this interview, what are some of your most fond memories of your childhood and looking back over the years
Well, the childhood, I think, would be... Now, when we had the store, 2 years we had the store, I mean, I used to help do the deliveries, and I had a dog, Peter the dog, I had him trained. He'd with a harness on him, and he'd pull the cart, and we'd deliver our groceries up the hill, and he'd go and gee and haw and all things like that. And we used a sled in the wintertime.
You used to deliver groceries?
Mm-hmm. Deliver groceries
probably
for years.
Probably didn't charge for it either.
Oh, no, we didn't charge for it. But we delivered groceries. And then if there were large orders, of course, Dad would deliver them. But
by what? By...
Just by carrying them. Carrying them. Of course, you must remember that he grew up in the grocery business as a young man when you had to take barrels of potatoes up, barrels of apples upstairs to people's homes and things like that. So he was used to that type of work. And an interesting thing, aside from Renforth, but he used to tell us that one of the gentlemen who used to live in Renforth, but was a traveler for the Red Rose Tea, and it was just when Red Rose Tea brought out their Red Rose brand, and they were packaging it under Red Rose, and it was in those days when you were just starting out to give stores their own brand, and Dad worked for T.A. Dunlop. And Armstrong came in to Mr. Dunlop this day, and he said, "How about us giving you?" He said, "I can give you a nice package with your under your own label, and we'll call it TAD, Tad, with T.A. Dunlop." And he said, "I'll give you some samples, and when your salesman," in those days you didn't have telephones or anything, the salesman went to your house, they had their regular route, and they went to the house to get your order, you see, and then they deliver it. And he said, "I'll give you some samples, and when your salesmen go out, they can take them out, and they can have a cup of tea, and you can come back and tell you how you like it." So this is what happened, and Dad got his samples, and he had this very dear old lady he used to call on, and he said, now, here's a package of tea, which is TAD, and we are going to try it, and we think it's very nice. And he said, "Tomorrow, when I come, you can make us a cup of tea, and we'll have it." So this happened, and the next day they had their cup of tea, and they had their talk, and Dad said, "Well, now how do you like this tea?" "Oh, it's very nice, but it can't compare to my Red Rose." Of course, there was a private label from Red Rose.